Yeah, so the focus of this talk is on sort of algorithms for number theoretic problems. And so, you know, in quantum computing, we have these efficient quantum algorithms for solving various problems related to number theory, like factoring Pell's equation, and more generally, just with number fields, there are these problems, unit group, class group, multiple ideal problems. And the focus of this talk is a different number theoretic problem, which is still related to number fields, and the goal is to compute extensions of a number field. So someone gives you a number field and you want to compute an extension of that. Okay. So number fields have applications even classically. So there's so number fields have a, so you might be, you know, you might have heard of the number field sieve. This is the fastest known classical algorithm for factoring. Some key exchange system was built on the hardness of the principal ideal problem in number fields. And now today our motivation is based on sort of lattice-based crypto, building some classical crypto systems that are based on lattices that come from towers of number fields. And this is where computing the extensions comes in. So I'll spend a couple of slides giving some examples to see about number fields. So a number field is it's a finite extension of the rational numbers, Q. So you can always write it as Q adjoined some number theta is algebraic, root of some polynomial of rational coefficients. And so in general, the field is just going to be like this polynomial evaluation at the generator, beta. That's the set of all elements in the field, and it's a field, so you have addition, multiplication, division. So I'll show you a couple of examples. So that's not really an example. That's sort of the most general case. So the simplest number field is just Q. If you adjoin nothing, okay, Q is a number field, just the rational numbers A over B. Another example is the cyclotomics. So in the cyclotomics, you take Q and you adjoin a pth root of unity. Right. So pth root of unity is algebraic. It's a root of x to the p minus 1. And then an arbitrary element in this field can be written like this, right? So it's like this polynomial in omega p up to p minus 2. So this is a degree p minus 1 extension. So in general, for a number field, you can always view it, it's a vector space over Q, and the dimension is the degree of the number field. So up here, this in general, you have, this would be called degree n. You can just think of matching up the coefficients AI with the element in the field, right? You could equally think of it as the number or just the vector of coefficients. And down here, this is degree p minus 1, so that people know why omega to the p minus 1. This crowd probably knows why omega to the p minus 1 is not part of the basis. So this is a basis. This uniquely represents every element in the field. And we don't need omega to the p minus 1, right, just because of this identity, right? So you can write omega to the p minus 1 as a function of the lower degrees, so that would not be included. You'd not get anything new by adding that here. It wouldn't be a basis. Okay. So that's an example for the cyclotomics.
And it gets lower when p is smaller triangles.
Yeah.
Okay.
Phi of m for degree. Yeah. Okay, and here's another common example, which is the real quadratic case. So you take positive, say, non-square integer d, and you adjoin square root d to this. So this has degree 2. Every element in the field can be written as a plus b square root d, where a and b are rational numbers. And just to give you an example where you can get division from, right? So every element has to have an inverse. And so to see how you get an inverse here, you could take the number and multiply it, what's called the conjugate, which just means you negate the square root d. So you have a plus b square root d, a minus square root d. And that gives you an integer over here. And then since you're allowed to divide by integers, you can get one. These are a couple of examples on number fields. Any other questions on similar? All right, so we're interested in computational problems with number fields. So someone hands you a number field, you want to compute some properties about it, or in this talk we want to compute extensions. And you can do all kinds of basic stuff with these. So someone can specify a number field either by its generator to some precision, doesn't matter what, you know, just enough precision, or they could specify it with a minimal polynomial. There are classical polynomial time algorithms that go back and forth, computing roots of polynomials, computing the minimal polynomial. And there are algorithms for doing all the basic operations, addition, multiplication, you know, it's all efficient. And what we'd like to do is to compute extensions, okay? So you can think of what our goal is. If someone hands us some number field, so they specify what the generator is, for example, and we want to compute some extension, okay? So a bigger number field that contains the field below. So first I'll show you this sort of easy case, which is, you know, it's really easy to compute some extension, okay? Let's start with an example. So suppose someone gives you, you know, this cyclotomic field with omega p. It's really easy to compute some extension, right? What you can do is you can just throw in another algebraic number that's not contained in this field. And you can do that by picking another, say, q through to unity, where q is some other prime. So you could take the one you had here, you could throw in this new root of unity, you'd get a bigger number field, right? It would be an extension. So not too bad. And you can do this in general. You know, someone gives you a general number field, an arbitrary number field, you could still pick a p through to unity. As long as p is large enough, you're going to get something new, right? So if you pick p minus 1 greater than n, then we know that omega p can't be down here. Because if omega p is in there, then it's generating a degree p minus 1 extension. But if this was only degree n, right, it can't be in there. So it's easy just to compute some extension. And what we're after in this talk, though, is to compute a specific kind of extension, and that's called a Hilbert class field. So the Hilbert class field, that was one of the things in the title. So if someone gives us a number field, we want to compute an extension of that. And, okay, and it's called the Hilbert class field. And so, you know, its definition is, I put it small, so, oops, it's the maximal, it's the, oh boy. The maximal abelian unramified extension. Okay, so it's not important to know what this definition means for the talk, but I'll say a couple of things about it. All right. So, okay, maximal probably we're okay with, but okay, abelian deals with the Galois group of the extension. So you look at the Galois group of the extension this over this, and it's supposed to be abelian. Not much is understood about the non-abelian case. And unramified, if you're curious, has to deal with how prime ideals downstairs in the ring of integers factor when you sort of take them upstairs into the bigger ring. So you start with the ring of integers down here, you take a prime ideal P, you take it into the ring of integers, you want to make it an ideal in the bigger ring, the bigger number field, so you close it under the ring of integers in the bigger one, and then you factor it. So when you take this prime down here, you bring it upstairs and you factor it, you look at what the coefficients are. And if they're all 0 or 1, that means it's unramified. Okay. So
what are the advantages of unramified extensions?
Thank you for asking. So there are different properties. There are different cases where this helps. In this case, the ramification is going to have to deal with how the discriminant grows for the number field. So without saying what the discriminant is. So in particular, the root discriminant will stay constant. So that's the final goal. We want to compute a tower of number fields where the root discriminant stays constant. And this ramification controls how that thing grows. So we either want no ramification or we want even limited ramification is okay sometimes.
So the first examples you gave an example of something that would clearly be a non-trivial extension.
Yeah.
I'm just confused. What is the hard computational problem? Is it if you give me an element to a join, that's easy to do?
Yeah, these are easy. You can computationally do this with no problem.
So the problem is we don't really know when you describe it as a maximal abelian unramified extension, it's sort of being described in some way that doesn't really tell you what you want to be a join.
Right. That's right. And in particular, cyclotomics wouldn't work because they always have ramification at P. So, yeah. So it's some description, and we don't know what it is or where it is, and that's...
Do we know they would exist?
No, sometimes it's trivial. So this extension is determined by the class group of the base field. So if the class group is trivial, then the extension is trivial. I mean, it might be itself, right?
Is it, so I'm a little confused, is it a construction, or is it just this?
This is just a definition. In case you wanted to know what the definition was. Right, so this is the definition of Hilbert class field. It's the maximal abelian unramified extension of this field.
It's maximal in dimension?
The maximal field. Yeah, it's going to be dimensional. It's field size.
And there's a unique one.
Yeah. Oh, no.
What
yeah.
P again? You said it was a...
This is a prime ideal inside the ring of integers.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So what does it mean for the Galois group to be abelian? I mean, like how should I think about it? What
it's a finite group.
Yeah, so simply. Yeah. Well, what's the intuition behind it having that property?
The intuition behind it having that property? I mean, it either does or it doesn't.
Yeah, I understand that, but like, you know, other things you can say when it does, or other things that you can say when it doesn't.
They don't it's not well understood what happens when it's not abelian. This is sort of the case that's understood.
Understood in the sense that...
There's a one-to-one correspondence between the subfields of this field and the subgroups of the Galois
okay,
group.
So
yeah, but not...
Yeah, so what do we know if we know that the Galois group is abelian? You just said some things, but you said some stuff
outside. I'll say them later. How about that?
So, okay. Sorry.
Yeah.
Can I go back to one more?
Yeah. Oh, no.
So in the example where you were joining a, in the case where you felt like you understood,
yeah.
There,
yeah.
What is the, if I take, just out of curiosity, what is the
Galois
group of the extension over the
walls? Do you know offhand? I don't know. So it's the... Do you know offhand? I don't know. I mean, I don't know what this extension is, so we need to know what the... right, it's the set of automorphisms of the field that fix the base field. Okay. So whatever it is, that's what we're trying to compute. Okay? And so I'll show you what the theorems look like that we have. So the first one is, you know, computing, we want to compute the Hilbert class field, and actually it's just a degree 2 subextension. The Hilbert class field in general might be really big, it might be exponentially large, or in general it's very hard to compute. So we're starting with a special case, which is a degree 2 subextension. And what we show is that it reduces to computing these other problems. So we show a classical efficient reduction to computing the unit group. So, you know, if you look at the base field that you're trying to extend, you have to compute the unit group of that field, the class group, you have to be able to factor ideals in the ring of integers, compute discrete logs in finite fields.
Okay. Does degree 2 subextension mean that it just increases the degree of the field by 2?
Factor of 2.
Wait, so does that mean in the case where the computing, so the Hilbert class field is not just of a, right, so I'm a little confused.
Mm-hmm.
You said the Hilbert class field can be quite big?
Yes.
So what does it mean to be a degree 2, you mean something of degree 2 that sits inside the Hilbert class
yeah.
field?
Yeah. Right? Yeah, the relative extension has degree 2.
The degrees themselves can be big of the field and the extension, just the relative.
Yeah, so suppose you're given a number field with degree n.
Right.
The Hilbert class field might be huge, a degree that's a lot larger than that.
Mm-hmm.
But the relative degree, the amount you go up, right, is by some factor. I'm
so
saying.
That's a degree divided by the other.
Yeah, so that's a degree 2 subextension.
Okay, so if you go from n to 2.
Yeah. Okay. And so the other one is about the Ray class group. So this is a sort of a more general construction that we might want to look at later on. If we don't want to do the Hilbert class field might turn out to be too restrictive for what we're trying to do. And so then there's something called the Ray class field. And in order to compute the Ray class field, we need the Ray class group. So we show that the Ray class group reduces similarly to these problems. And in the title I added quantum to the top because we know, you know, when the number field has constant degree, we have efficient quantum algorithms for all these problems. So then you get an efficient quantum algorithm for solving this.
So if you keep doing the first procedure,
yeah,
you eventually get to the maximum at the Hilbert class.
I'm not sure offhand. I think so, but I'm actually not sure. Any other questions?
I'm still confused.
Okay. What are you confused about?
So the theorem applies if you somehow know that the Hilbert class field is a degree 2 sub-extension?
When there is a degree 2 sub-field, when there is one, you can get it. There might not be one.
But there's a unique Hilbert class field.
Yes.
You're not computing the Hilbert class field, you're computing something inside of it, is that right?
Or yes.
Did I get that wrong?
No.
Oh,
yes.
Okay.
Computing
oh.
A subfield, that's what I mean by sub-extension, subfield of the Hilbert class field, of degree 2.
It might not exist.
No, it does not always exist, when it does exist.
But it's a subfield that does contain the original field?
Yes.
Yes,
it's in between the two fields.
Okay. Yes,
it's in between the two fields. Yeah. So I used to have this stuff way later in the talk, but I thought people would be asleep by, you know, or lost by then, so I put it here, but, okay, yeah?
Is the delta you have on there?
No, delta is, you can think of that as the input. So it somehow describes the size of the number field. So when you say Q adjoint theta, there's actually an integer that's associated with that, which is delta. It's called a discriminant. And polynomial time means being polynomial and log discriminant. Any other questions?
Yeah, so can you, again, is there something you can say about the motivation for wanting to do this?
Okay. So, so now that we're through that, I'll switch gears for a few slides and talk about some of the motivation for this. Okay, so let's switch gears for a minute and talk about quantum computing and classical crypto, right? Breaking crypto. So we know that quantum can break several things like RSA, Diffie-Hellman, elliptic curve crypto, this Bruckmann-Williams key exchange system that I mentioned before, and some algebraically homomorphic encryption systems. And so far, there are still some classical systems. Oh, I guess I didn't add Gentry's new algebraically homomorphic encryption scheme here yet, but, oh no, that falls under one. So there are a lot of different lattice-based crypto systems. These have not been broken yet. There's Mikley's, and there's this proposal by Moore, Russell, and Vazirani to base a system on the hidden subgroup problem.
Sean?
Yeah?
When you say secure, I guess, it means not proven to be insecure, or is proved to be secure?
No, nothing is ever proven to be secure.
It could be that P equals S
T. Yeah. And we don't know. I mean, the proof of security is like, you know, how many people have spent how many hours trying to break it? I don't know what the answer is. But certainly for this, you know, probably not enough yet. So in the motivation for these number field problems is going to be from the lattice-based crypto. So independently of having things that are not breakable by quantum, people have been studying lattice-based crypto a lot because they have an extra security guarantee that RSA, for example, does not have, that nothing else has that we know of. So if you think about RSA, first of all, it has an average case assumption. We have to assume that when you choose a random P and Q and multiply them, that that whole distribution is hard on average, right? And second of all, the reduction is kind of in the wrong direction. We know that breaking RSA reduces to factoring, but that doesn't say how hard breaking RSA actually is. And for lattice-based systems, they have the opposite. They have the direction, the reduction in the right direction. So what they can show is you can take a worst-case lattice problem and reduce it to breaking the crypto system. So over here, you have an average case distribution, right? You set up your keys and everything by choosing them randomly from some distribution. And if you can break that, then you can solve the worst case problem. So this is a much stronger guarantee than you have for the other systems. So I guess there are sort of three different directions people have been working on. So one thing is improving the worst case assumptions. Another one is to make the systems more efficient. You know, so people are still using RSA a lot, I guess. So they'd like to make the lattice-based crypto systems competitive with RSA, and building more primitives for different types of crypto primitives. And one of the things they're doing for making these more efficient is they're using special case lattices. Okay, and so that's sort of the goal of this number field extension, is you can get special case lattices out of these number fields.
So there's other directions for people who want to use the crypto system rather than break it.
Yes. Okay. This is trying to build a classical crypto system. Okay, in case some people have not seen it before, right, a lattice is specified by some linearly independent vectors in R to the N. So here in two dimensions, we have this example where it's given B1 and B2, and the lattice is all integer linear combinations of those points. So you have these points here. And there are an infinite number of bases for any lattice. So you might be given a basis that's like this. It's very skewed, very long vectors. And one of the main problems that comes up here is, given a basis for your lattice, you want to try and compute a short basis. Right? So maybe someone specifies these two, and you're trying to compute one that's very close to the origin. That's the problem that's hard. So what people look at instead of solving it exactly is the approximate SVP, because it has different hardnesses for different approximation factors. So if you're trying to get the shortest vector to within a constant factor, if you want to find any vector that's within a constant factor of the shortest, that's known to be NP-hard. And we don't know how to build crypto systems on NP-hard problems, based on NP-hard problems. On the other hand, if you're just trying to find any vector that's within a 2 to the n factor of the shortest, that's the LLL algorithm. You can compute that in polynomial time. So the crypto land is sort of when you're trying to find a vector that's within a polynomial factor of the shortest. And so there's a hardness assumption here. You know, we assume it's hard to compute a vector that's within a polynomial factor, and then you build a crypto system based on that assumption.
What is the N?
N is the dimension of the lattice. Oh. All right. So as I said, you know, people have been using special case functions special case lattices in order to make the crypto schemes more efficient. So these might hold for general lattices, but then people start looking at special cases. So for example, there's an example of a hash function where you pick a random integer matrix mod Q, and your hash function computes A times Y mod Q. This is another way to describe a lattice if you look at linear equations mod Q. And so apparently this is inefficient in practice. So one way they've specialized this is to use circulant matrices. So instead of using a whole matrix all with different entries, they split it up into blocks where the first row is, you know, for each block you just take the cyclic shifts of the row above it to fill up that block. So in order to describe A, you only describe the top row now. That uses a lot less randomness to select the key, and it's also easier to compute matrix multiplication when you have circulant matrices. Right? So that's an example. So here the worst case assumption is that you would not be able to solve shortest vector problem when, say, the lattice is actually cyclic. So this is when you take a lattice vector. If you cyclically shift the vectors, it's still you still get a lattice vector. It's a special case. And they've also looked at other types of ideal lattices. So you work in this polynomial ring, mod and irreducible. And then there, the worst case assumption that you're basing your crypto system on is, can you solve the shortest vector in these ideal lattices? So people have been working with a lot of different variations on these, trying to improve the efficiency to compete with RSA. And also to reduce this approximation factor that you're assuming is hard. So you'd like to get this approximation factor that I mentioned where crypto lies to be as small as possible, because you don't want it to be up here where it's polynomial time, and you probably can't get it down to this constant where it's NP hard. But it makes a difference if it's N squared or N cubed or N to the seventh or something like that for your hardness assumption. Okay. And so there are even more worst case assumptions. For example, there are some lattices that have a unique shortest vector. So you pick a special kind of lattice where the shortest vector is much shorter than the rest. You try and find a short vector in there. Okay, so this is getting to, you know, the motivation for our work now. So these worst case to average case reductions I mentioned that happened for lattices, so there was a crypto system, the iTyke Dork crypto system, that had that assumption based on the unique SVP lattices instead of general lattices. Regev gave a system that was based on SVP, but originally in his work the reduction to show the security was actually a quantum reduction. So there the assumption, well, it used to be you would assume that there's no quantum algorithm for a shortest vector problem, and then if so, if that's true, then the crypto system is secure. And then Pikert recently showed that you can make that reduction classical. Now in terms of making them more efficient, looking at ideal lattices, so you take a ring somewhere, you take ideals, and those ideals will be lattices. There's this one for efficient hash functions by Michiancio. And what we're really after here is a proposal by Pikert and Rosen where you improve the connection factor. So when you do this reduction from the worst case lattice to the average case lattice, there's a blow up in the problem size. And the connection factor tells you how much it blows up. And you'd like to keep that as small as possible. And that's the goal. So the goal is to get this connection factor to be small. Okay, so that's some motivation on why we're looking at these. We're trying to construct lattices that have special properties that will be useful for crypto because it'll be more efficient. In this case, it'll reduce the connection factor. So now I'll switch back.
So when you talk about ideal lattices, yeah. The ring can be it can be a function field or a number field, like both terms apply to it, or is it always number field?
Well, these ones they were using are polynomial rings. So you take Z adjoin X mod a polynomial.
Function fields.
And now we're looking in this work at number fields. So I'll switch back to number fields now, and I'll talk a little bit about where the lattices come from to just give you an idea. All right, so remember before we were talking about someone gives you a number field and you want to try and do some computational problems with it. So there's some standard things you can do when someone gives it to you. So here's just an example, again, of the real quadratic number field. So inside any number field, there's something called the ring of integers. And sometimes, for some values of D, it turns out that it's just Z adjoin this thing, which means that you would have a plus b squared with d, where a and b are integers. And then inside that ring, you have, you know, an infinite number of ideals. And this is where you get the lattices from. So given a number field, you look at the ring of integers. So there's a way to embed the ring of integers into r to the n. In this case, it's r squared. And the way it's working here is it's taking the basis elements. So a basis for this ring is 1 and square root d. And you embed each of those. So one gets mapped to 1, 1. And in general, you map to the conjugates of the elements. So this one gets mapped to square root d minus square root d. And that gives you a two-dimensional lattice. And then all the ideals are going to be sublattices of that. Okay. So all the ideals map to sublattices. So you can imagine getting a number field and then looking in there for these lattices. Okay. I have one more example. I don't know if this is going to be good. So what, you know, what Peikert and Rosen were doing is they were taking some number field and they were saying, okay, if you have a number field of some degree n, right? So it's a vector space over Q of degree n, then what you can do is you can get out these lattices that come from the ideals, and these are all ideals of dimension n. And what they showed over here is that among these ideals, you have a worst case to average case reduction, where you can try and build crypto systems, and if you use Hilbert class fields, they'll have the right property that you want. Okay, I wrote this example down. I don't know if this is... So I'll talk through it and see. This is just to try and give you some idea of what one of these lattices might look like. So if you had Q adjoint square root of 5, then what you do is you take the different embeddings. So there are ways... So any number field has... So if you have a number field of degree n, you can embed it into the complex numbers in n different ways. And those n different ways of embedding, of putting it in there, is called the embeddings. And so for Q adjoint square root 5, you'd have four embeddings. I wrote down two of them. So these are the basis elements. And then the lattice would be all integer linear combinations of these vectors here. And each column just corresponds to a different embedding. So there's something fishy going on with this example because the embeddings are actually the same. Usually the embeddings are different than the actual basis elements.
Square root of 5, do you mean fifth root of unity?
Oh, that's it. Yeah, I meant fifth root of unity. Oh, yeah. Thank you. Yeah. So, you know, you would take this basis, and then to get all the rest of the lattices, you would just take the sublattices of this. So somehow this is describing an infinite set of lattices. And they're going to have special properties because they're coming in. So these are lattices, but they're also ideals. So you can multiply your vectors and things like that. All right. So let's get back to Tauer. So remember the very beginning of the talk now, I was talking how we wanted to compute an extension. Okay. So from this Peikert-Rosen paper, what they were looking for is basically the following computational problem. Given some integer n, which would specify the degree of the number field, you'd want to output a number field with bounded root discriminant. So yeah, I didn't define this earlier, but this is this parameter that describes how big the input is. And if you take discriminant to the 1 over n, you want that to stay constant. So there's only one way that's known how to do this, and this is through going through a Tauer. So you can imagine a Tauer of growing number fields, so you would compute an extension, an extension, an extension, and the whole Tauer would satisfy that the root discriminant never changes, and that would give you what you're after. Okay, so what they actually showed is that the connection factor is something like the root discriminant times basically log n. So for any other worst case to average case reduction, the connection factor is at least linear. So this is a huge improvement. And in fact, we don't even need this to stay constant, right? Because we're just trying to beat linear. So this could even be pretty big, and we would still beat the best known bounds if we could compute these. So the main open problem they listed in their paper was, how do you actually compute this? Given a degree, you know, find me a number field that has this property. So that's our main motivation. And they've also been used in error-correcting codes, where the rate is some function that, you know, somewhere it's like minus the root discriminant, so you want the root discriminant to stay small in order to build these error-correcting codes. Debbie, do you have a question?
Yeah.
What's the question?
What is the root discriminant?
Okay, so the discriminant, so I'm not going to define it, but it's, like I said, it's an integer that describes the input size. So when someone specifies a number field to you, you want the, you know, you can think of the input size as being discriminant. So that's how you always measure the running time. It's in log discriminant, polynomial log discriminant. Okay, so... such a Tauer is known to exist, through this Hilbert class field. So what you can imagine doing is starting with some base number field, and then computing the Hilbert class field of that, and then computing the Hilbert class field of that, and then just continuing on forever. And that would give you, that would describe a sequence of number fields that would have bounded root discriminant.
Sorry.
Yeah.
So I don't claim to understand what a Hilbert class field is at all, but when you defined it, it had this word maximal in there.
Yeah.
So if you start with a field, you find the Hilbert class field, which is its extension.
Yeah.
Then when you do that again,
you get something. It's not. It's not a function of the. It's a function of the new field.
Okay. So this definition of maximal extension and all of that, you start over from some new.
That's right.
Okay.
You start over from the new number field.
Okay.
The reason for that is that the other requirement was that the Galois group was a BU, and so the Galois group now takes the bigger field as its basis. So now you have an extension that is Galois. The Galois extension is a medium.
I see. So in other words, if you took the larger field with your original field, the Galois field would not be abelian.
Apparently.
But if you take the new large field, you can find fields that include that where the Galois group is abelian.
Seems to be the case.
Yeah, roughly. I mean, I don't. The non-abelian case isn't well understood, so I don't know what happens with the non-abelian case.
Okay.
But it's just the fact that you start over with a new one.
But that says how it's okay. Yeah, if you just found the maximum, then how do you extend it further?
Right. Well, that was what I was wondering.
Yeah.
But I don't understand
it
well enough, really.
To,
yeah. Okay.
So this discriminant is not a proper function on fields. You can have infinitely many.
Infinitely many.
Or not. It looks like, I think the last line of your slide, I thought you took this construction and iterated it, got larger and larger fields, but you said the discriminant stayed the same.
Oh, no, sorry, the root discriminant, so to the 1 over n. Question?
I was just wondering if it might be you had to have infinitely many in the sense of like if the discriminant you said was an integer and the number of fields was not countable.
Well, you're going to be getting larger and larger, so.
Right. Okay.
All right. So. Yeah, so this is the strategy. We want to start with a number field of small degree and try and compute this, iterate this thing where we compute the Hilbert class field at each step. So it's not even trivial to find actually towers like this that are infinite. There's a theorem called the Golod-Shefarovich theorem, which gives certain conditions on the base field so that you get an infinite one. So here are two examples of base fields where if you use these, you get infinite towers. So the extension actually, the degree of the extension actually depends on the size of the class group. So Todd, this is a little bit related to what you were asking. So to know what the degree of the next extension is, you look at the class group of the current number field. And that changes at each step. It's not well understood. Okay. So if the class group is trivial for one of the number fields here, it would stop. And this condition makes it so it's never trivial.
That was a condition you mentioned before where the extension is just the field is
going. Yeah. Okay, so as I said, computing sort of, so we're only doing a small part of this, right? We're computing a sub-extension of one Hilbert class field, so one that we know is not too big to write down, first of all, and not too hard to compute. Well, at least we know how to compute it. And like I said, so it reduces to these problems that we already know how to solve. So I'll just mention what these were. So in, this is another set of computational problems, right? So we're trying to compute extensions, but given a number field, there are these three problems that I mentioned. So given a number field, you can compute the ring of integers. So computing the ring of integers reduces to factoring. So for quantum, it's not a problem. And then you have these ideals inside your ring of integers. So the first problem is computing the unit group. So the unit group is the set of invertible elements in the ring of integers. And because the representation size is actually too large, you can't even in general write down a unit. You actually have to go through some log embedding where you compute the log of the unit and you round it, you know, you just have to up to some approximation. And that turns out to be a lattice. So to compute the unit group, you're basically determining the basis for some unknown lattice. The second problem is the class group. So there you take your ideals modulo the principal ideals. So when you do this, it turns out that the class group is finite. And this is the group that determines the extension for the Hilbert class field. So the size of this is going to tell you what the degree looks like. And then there's this last problem, the principal ideal problem. If you're given an ideal, or say you're given a principal ideal alpha times O, you'd like to know if it's a principal or to actually compute the generator if it is. Okay, so we have quantum algorithms for these when the degree of the number field is constant. So here's the definition again. We're trying to compute the Hilbert class field. It's the maximal unramified abelian extension. We'd like to do that because of this constant root discriminant that happens. And so I guess I've already been saying this, but you know, when you do this, the degree, the relative degree is exactly the size of the class group. So different things can happen. It could be trivial. The class group has size 1. It doesn't grow at all. It could be exponentially large. That would also be a problem. You might not, you know, can't even write down, can't even describe what the extension is in polynomial time. And that's one of the reasons why we restricted to this degree 2 for a starting point. So this was the theorem I mentioned earlier. We can do a degree 2. So if you think about the number field you're given and the Hilbert class field of it, then inside there you have subfields, and there's a one-to-one correspondence between the subfields of the Hilbert class field and the subgroups of the class group. So, you know, you use the quantum, you use the whatever algorithm to compute the class group of the base field, and then you have an idea of what these look like. Okay. So there are, you know, people have studied this classically from a computational perspective in terms of like actually running the algorithms on small examples, and what we were really doing was making these things asymptotically efficient. So we had to deal with different things. One thing we really had to do was change to what are called compact representations. So as I mentioned, these units can be exponentially large, and we have to use this compact representation where you have like log of the unit rounded off. Then there are some other things we have to deal with, virtual units, some group called OK mod M star. We need to be able to factor ideals in the ring of integers. And actually, I'll talk about that in a minute. I don't know, how long should I go? I've gone 45 minutes. Let's change the topic? Okay. Well, maybe I'll just say something about ideal factorization. So ideal factorization, we thought was kind of interesting because, you know, well, integer factorization, ideal factorization, what does it take to factor ideals? And for this one, this was on the list of things we needed to reduce to get the Hilbert class field. And what we showed for this is that it just reduces to factoring integers, so factoring the norm of ideal. If you're given an ideal in the ring of integers, and you want to compute the factorization. It's a polynomial time except for factoring the norm. And you know, so you can, this is in Cohen's book, sort of a description of this, but there's no analysis of the running time, so we had to go through this. So I'll just give you an idea of how this goes, and then I'll stop after that. So. Basically, there are two steps. What you want to do is you want to compute the prime ideals lying above a prime integer for each prime integer in the factorization of the norm, and then you just compute valuations. So valuations like just computing the exponent that appears up here. So we show that each of these is polynomial time.
Sorry, why are you not done after step one?
We're trying to factor the ideal.
Oh,
And this is factoring an integer.
Right. So the PIs and the EIs do not tell you.
Oh, well, first of all, those EIs are not the same. Sorry, sorry about that. second of all, these P's are also not the same. No, these are actually a different font, right? Okay, that's math brash. Is that your question?
Sure, so I'm wrong.
Okay. So I'll just give you a, sort of an idea how this goes. So there's something called the easy case, which is very easy to find in the literature. So the easy case, it's some technical condition about P not dividing this index. And so what you do is you take your generator of the field, you compute the minimal polynomial for that, and then you factor it mod P, which can be done efficiently. And then it's pretty simple. The primes lying above P, these are the potential factors in your ideal, you can just compute from these factors. So it's P times the ring of integers plus this factor you got here evaluated at theta times OK. So you just have them. Okay. So this part is not too bad.
So these are all candidates?
These are candidates. Yeah, these are candidates. And then you check them.
And there are not too many candidates?
No.
You don't have to worry about that?
No. Not too many candidates.
Is it obvious how to do? Is this problem easy for rings of so function fields with integers there? You do it for number of fields. The methods are very specific for number of fields.
I'm not sure what the link is, but yeah. Yeah, I don't know the answer to your question.
I was wondering if you could generalize what you said. It works for fields, integers, without specifying it. But have to do number of fields.
It's a good question. Yeah, I'm not sure.
Can I ask you really dumb question? What is the minimal polynomial of theta? That is F. I don't know what that is.
So it's the minimal, you know, it has minimal degree. The root, theta is a root of that polynomial. Monic. What other property does it have? Is that good enough? Integer coefficient. I guess if it's an integer, it's an integer coefficient.
Well, you can also make
it. Yeah. All right. Well, getting late. So there are two steps. I'll try and zip through them. So the main idea is to use this P radical. So you're looking at the set of elements in your ring where some power is in P times OK. And this has this really nice property that it's actually the product of the primes that you want, but all with exponent 1. And this gives you a very special property where if you look at OK mod this radical, then you can, if you use Chinese remainder theorem, you get finite fields and as all the direct products. And that gives you some extra structure that allows you to compute with them. You actually get an FP algebra, and you can use linear algebra very easily over that. So the two steps are, first you compute this ideal, which has this nice factorization, and then you can split that up. That's the first step. This is how to compute IP. Maybe I'll skip this. But the main point is because everything's in FP algebra, you can use linear algebra in order to compute generators for this. The second thing is splitting them. So there's sort of a standard trick on how to split things up. Because it's a direct product, you know that has idempotents, right? Because you know you always have something like 1 comma 0. So when you square it, you get it back. That's an idempotent. And then, so the algorithms to compute an idempotent, which has this property that if you multiply e times 1 minus e, you get 0, right? Because you have e minus e squared is 0. And then these are your two factors. You get two non-trivial factors, I plus e times OK, I plus 1 minus e times OK. And you know your ideal splits that way. And you can check that this is actually, that their product is I. I won't go through that. Okay, let's see. So So those are the two steps
so
for the.
Can you compute an island problem by taking a random one and you kind of see if you raise it to power, you find the period and you
don't
take off the periods?
I don't think so. Now there's another trick, I think. Is yours classically efficient?
No, I'm just kind of ad hoc here, trying to think how you find an item problems, but I could see, like, you know, take E squared,
E three. What's E, though? Oh, you mean a random element.
And then you kind of, like, a period finding a thing.
I don't know if that'll work. Well, how big's the period? Yeah, I don't know. I can tell you later.
What's that? Yeah, then you can try again.
Try again. Okay, so those were the two. So that's just supposed to give you sort of a very, very quick overview of how the ideal factorization works. So that reduced it to factoring, because all these steps I showed you in the last two slides are classical. Okay, I'll skip the Ray class group. Okay, summary. So we have two basic objects from class field theory that we're trying to compute. They also appear in applications for computer science. One is computing these degree two sub-extensions, and the other one is the Ray class group. That's actually a picture of the Ray class group. So remember I showed you the class group that was like, it had four elements on that other slide. The Ray class group has some different definition that splits things up more. It's more complicated to compute. Okay, so you know, eventually our goal is to try and compute towers. So we try and compute larger subfields of Hilbert class fields. It seems like we can probably do it if maybe prime size extensions, if the prime is in the field. But there are lots of problems with how to get this to work. And then we could try and compute multiple steps in the tower. Now, one negative thing about the Hilbert class field tower is once you define the base field, the whole thing is set. And maybe it has some properties that make it hard to compute. So another thing we're looking at is computing Ray class field towers. And you know, this is sort of the picture. So there's an extra parameter so that at each step you specify something called a modulus. And then depending on which modulus you pick, you get different extensions. So at every level you have lots more choices on how to go up. And we're hoping that maybe we can find a way up that tower that's easier to compute and has the right properties. Okay, still open is everything in arbitrary degree is still hard, right? So these problems we can solve are all for constant degree number fields, but if you let the degree grow, it's very hard. And one of the reasons is the algorithms, at least the way they're currently done, they actually solve a shortest vector problem in ideal lattices. But we don't know how to solve that efficiently. It'd be nice to get around that somehow. And another open problem would be actually to break the cryptosystems based on ideal lattices, or you could use this maybe to compute unit groups and those other things we want to compute. So there are a couple extra features that these have. So first of all, if you look at these towers of number fields where you have constant root discriminant, then you actually know the length of the shortest vector up to some small factor. And that's not true for the arbitrary lattices. So this is one of the extra properties. And also there's sort of the obvious one that it's an ideal, so you can multiply your vectors. Okay, so I'll end on this slide here. There's all these problems. You know, we're looking at someone hands you a number field and you want to compute all these problems. You want the unit group, you want the principal ideal problem, solve shortest lattice vector problem in the ideal lattices, computing the class group and the Ray class group, and then hopefully eventually computing these towers. Okay, thanks.